Last week, I took you from Romans 1:18 to the end of the chapter. Today, we back up a little. You should have three pieces of paper, none of which have what I have written on the board on it. And you should have Romans 1:19 and 1:20. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Last Sunday, we took a broad brush and covered the sins resulting from God turning people over. Just taking His hands off of them. Sometimes we take pictures, and you've seen it on TV out at our ranch when we take a horse out of the stall, open the gate into a large paddock, and turn them loose. And they jump and kick and run. That comes close, but the word in the Greek has an even stronger impetus added. Like you're turned loose on a downhill slope and given a shove. And so often the traditional church is concentrated on one kind of sin. You know, it's really true that when you're deprived, you get hung up on that which you're deprived of. In the traditional church, they just can't get off of sexual sins. They have so little of it. They're hung up on it. Now, you know, if you grow up in the traditional church, I don't know what's going to come out today. I'm going to tell you, you need to pray for your pastor. Not for what you're thinking right now. You need to pray for me because I've got a serious problem, but God is able. He's going to take care of it. I'm going to do like Cromwell, trust in God and keep my powder dry. I've been having some eye problems. And people have wondered when I'm going to fall right here as I step over these floor lights. You may have noticed I've been more wobbly the last few Sundays than normal. A couple of times I hit it when I went to write on the board, and then when I step back, I'm sort of off balance. Working on it, going to eye doctors. The science is moving on, but I can't read. No matter what glasses they give me, when I read now, I get unstable and dizzy. And it can affect your inner ear balance. So it's interfered with my study. I mean, hours that I normally am able to read to get ready for this Roman series, I have to take in short sections and then get up and wobble around until I straighten up. I will do what I have to do. I expect that 25 years, and I'm not going to forget the creator of the eye. And I'll do what I have to do. But I believe that God, having kept our powder dry, does His part. And not really my nature to ask to be ministered to. That's my role. But Paul wrote in his epistle about the whole armor of God, telling the saints to put it on, all kinds of prayer, and that old tiger at the end said, "And prayer for me." So I'm often calling the world to prayer for special needs. As long as I have eyes and a mouth, I can study and I can teach. And I'm calling you to prayer for this rather new problem for me. My eyes. So the reason I said, I don't know what's going to come out today, is I'm just going to have to, with God, make it up as I go. Use what research of the past comes to dwell on these verses until I can read again and stand up straight when I finish. I'm sure you will be in prayer about that, won't you? Now, if I'm blind, I have someone to lead me around. Come here, Melissa. You have no idea why I brought you up here, do you? All the talk I want to dispel. We got married. To do it while I can still see. Now, I know. If I'd known it made you that happy, I'd have done it sooner. You know, the Sunday we were gone, we got married on the 13th of August, so that I wouldn't have to work at remembering the anniversary. The 14th is my birthday, and it gives me a 2-month celebration now. And if I, when I'm 90, instead of riding 90 miles on my bike, if I can't make it, I'll ride the anniversary. See, next year I can ride either 1 year or 72 next year. I can ride 1 mile or 72 miles. You got that? I'd like to stop all the speculation. You've been seeing the ring, so I knew that you were gossiping. I said, okay, I'll pick the time. I have someone to read to me. And for the first time in a lifetime, someone who looks out for me. Message I was talking about seeing. You'll be praying, I need these eyes to finish the book of Romans. But today, as I move back off of that broad brush and the tendency of the traditional church to make sexual sins synonymous with sin and play down everything else and make sexual sins the unpardonable sin, I remind you again, the chapter ends with a list of 21 sins. And there's not a one of us that escape a hit off one of those sins. The second thing I want to point out, lest we forget it, Paul is emphasizing the importance and the urgency of the gospel message and getting it out for the hearers who need it. Because of two things. The slow boil of God's wrath. The two words, thumos and orge. Thumos comes from to pant, to breathe hard. It produces the art of breathing out fire from the nostrils in anger. Orgy, that which is unveiled at the gospel moment. It's been there, but the gospel releases it now, unveils it. The orgy, which is a slow boil of God. Against two things. Dikion. Against translated ungodliness, asabion. Against translated unrighteousness, adikion. Now, the Greek doesn't allow any middle, neutral, resting, deliberative, tentative, temporary zone. You're either going one way or the reverse. There's no neutral gear. God is PO'd. You know what that means? The letter, not the word. He's pee-offed. I got through that pretty good, didn't I? He's madder than hell. And it's been building up. In a slow boil. And it's getting worse. And eventually he's going to explode. And in the meantime, he's gotten off a little bit by just shoving people and turning them over. But he's madder than hell. You got any phobias, anybody? How many see a spider and they just... Let me see your hands. How many feel that way when you see a snake? You know, some people, they just hang on. Let them crawl on them. Something that just, when you see it, you want to either get away from it or destroy it. How many have something like that? Maybe it's your wife. Maybe it's your husband. Just your relatives in general. Maybe it's whatever. How many of you have something that you don't have to even think? Just to be exposed to it makes your stomach crawl, makes you get the... What's the word I used to use? The who? The scrunchies, that's it. The scrunchies. How many of you just... But it's worse than that. It doesn't just give you the scrunchies. You want to... You can rejoice when it's smashed. I mean, you ever have those feelings? You have orgy. Now, some of you have had fantasy ideas of what orgies were. Things that just turn you off. You can't stand to be around it. That's the way God feels about His creatures. The crowning achievement of this, not just universe, this entire realm of being, the one He made in His image, destined to be in His family, ruling and reigning throughout eternity. And He looks at it. In practiced, studied, non-God and dis-God awareness. Not even aware of it. Any of you ever gotten mad anywhere, any time in your life at being ignored? If you were God and could vent yourself, there would be no problem of population explosion, except one to diminish it. It's hard for us, even the scientists, the rationalists and the philosophers have made us a bit intimidated to think of God in angry tones, because that's anthropomorphizing God. Got through that one pretty good too, didn't we? We size Him up in our image. And it's somehow, I really find it ironic that asteroid orifices who don't believe in God belittle us for projecting man-like qualities onto God and calling it anthropomorphizing God or anthropomorphizing God, whichever way you want to use the $64 word. I mean, asteroid orifices who don't believe Him are going to belittle me because I, in their view, project to God a quality that's strictly human, and if there is a God, He can't be allowed to have these human traits. Well, fool, if I believe the Bible, He said He made me in His image. That includes some of my traits must be His. God being ignored. No God awareness. That's what a Sabian is. Adikion, unrighteous. It's the same as sinner. In his sins, it's to fall short. Man pursuing his way falls short of God's standard and breaks any covenant God makes with him. And as we will see when we get over into the third chapter, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, whatever your standard and whatever the level of your knowledge of what's right. Now we revel in it. Men love darkness better than light because their deeds are evil. But God hates sin. All of it. Spiritual sins as well as fleshly sins. Things left undone that should be done as well as things done that shouldn't be done. Where holiness and righteousness meet is that holiness means separation. I've defined it many times. In a saint, you saint something when you offer it to the deity and turn loose of it and exclusively separate it to the use of God. God himself is exclusively separated to his view of goodness and right. So angels can fly around as Isaiah saw them and sing, "Holy, holy, holy." And as he condescended to descend by light into the stream of human nature and shine a light in this dark world that led us to Christ and the gospel, there he had to separate himself and allow sinning man in person or through representative in his presence from the first time when he sought out Adam and Eve. Only when the shed blood, life paid out in death for sin, and covered with those skins, anticipating in a God in whom there is no time and for whom the lamb slain from the foundation of the world was the fail-safe, he could take these temporary pictures knowing there would come a time when the bank of heaven would empty itself in the blood of Christ and one worth enough for all of us would die in our place. That's the only way he could tolerate sin in his presence. But men love darkness better than light because their deeds are evil. They don't like the light. God is light. And maybe it's time someone tell us, which Paul is doing, God doesn't like our state. God doesn't like our behavior. God doesn't like our view of ourselves. God doesn't like our asteroid orifice justification of how we are. We are no good. Period. And yet we're his. He created us for something better. And he's got a slow boil because of this non-God awareness that characterizes our life. We only want God when we need him. I told you a few weeks ago out of R.C. Sproul's book, The Psychology of Atheism, that the major reason for atheism is not scientific proofs. It's a psychological state of mind that doesn't like God. Because any God to be God has to be all powerful, and we don't like that. Because we want to be. We're like a boss. It's worse this generation than in a long time. We like our little secrets. We don't want anybody to know how bad we really are because we know in our heart of hearts. And God's omniscient. To be God, He knows everything. And as I said a few weeks ago, out of Sproul, He's immutable. He doesn't change. You can't last Him out. You can't tolerate it until maybe you'll be there when He's gone. He's wholly good, and that condemns us. We don't like God. We'd rather exist without a God except when we need Him. Now, I'm trying to get you into God's view. A lot of you are parents. How many parents here? I don't want to ask for hands. I just want it to go into your heart because I don't want some of you have your children with you. But there must be, in the best of your children, times when your heart is breaking because of such a disappointment. And I have said this in the past. I've often wondered, what really goes through a mother's mind or a father's mind when you have refused to accept it? You've been lied to by your child. You know he's been framed or it's a mistake. And you have to face the fact you birthed a serial killer. A sexual, sadistic pervert that not only violates his victims but cuts them in pieces and enjoys it. A pedophile. And as a parent, you sit and they're about to go to the electric chair. And you have fought against accepting the truth, but you come to that moment when he is really guilty, assuming it's a son. I birthed him. I held him in my arms as a child. I did the best I can do and could do. I've tried every other excuse making I can. He's evil. Only if you can get a little close to that idea can you feel what God feels. These are His children. Flagrantly, abusively ignoring Him. Flagrantly, abusively gone their way. Refusing His way. Rebellion. And you cannot come close in your imagination to what God feels toward sin. Go back to that phobia frame I used a moment earlier. Where that to be in the presence of something, it sets you off. Because we wallow in it. Have gotten accustomed to its smells and its shape and all of its evil. It's the atmosphere we breathe. We cannot understand a separate, holy God, as Isaiah saw Him, sitting on a throne high and lifted up in Isaiah 6. And the angels flying around singing, "Holy, holy, holy." And He, for an instant, comprehended the separation and says, "Woe is me, I am undone. A man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of an unclean people. We're so far removed from the heart of God. Sin, it has to be the grossest kind to produce revulsion in us. It's not what God intended us to be. Thank God, it's a slow boil. But understand, from God's view, He has no tolerance for sin. But the same God who created us and loves us has always exhibited grace. He told Adam and Eve in some asteroid orifices, as I call them, though you know what I want to say, will criticize God, make it somehow a proof that the Bible and God are less than they are presented to be. Because God said if they ate of the fruit of that tree, they'd die. And they didn't. All kinds of arguments are given. At that moment, they begin to die. And I have oft-times quoted Henry Drummond's definition of life, which is capacity to relate to one's environment. And at that moment, they were cut off from the environment of God's eternal life, and their life energy began to wane, and mutation set in, and man began to degenerate from that high point. But the hard, cold facts are, the understanding of Adam and Eve is not to be somehow changed into what we define as die. They didn't know what the word meant. How could Adam and Eve know what death was? They'd never seen it, never occurred. They didn't even know what to die meant. So whatever it meant to them, it produced immediate separation from God and the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. But the other side of the coin is, as we've come to know what the Bible defines as death, the death of the body and the eternal death of separation from God into a place not only of separation, but torment and eternal, we have to conclude the immediate consequences of their sin was postponed. But God instantly gave us a glimpse that a price had to be paid in the killing of that animal and clothing them with its skins. God became angry and boiling at the evil on the antediluvian world, the pre-flood world. When there was such evil, God decided to destroy mankind. And He gave an order to name Methuselah when he was born. And the name Methuselah means when he dies, it arrives, or the end comes. So here's this kid, subsequently a man, walking on the face of the earth so full of evil that God's going to destroy. And God says when he dies, that's when the end comes. Ironically, no, amazingly, Methuselah, whose name means when he dies the end comes, is recorded as the oldest man living the longest time of any man ever on this earth. God could have burst his wrath forth when he was 2 years old, when he was 10, when he was 100. I mean, one of the traits of God in His name in many Revelation passages is long-suffering. He's long-suffering. The paradox is Don't let God's mercy and grace turn into a candy bar, gingerbread religion that forgets God hates sin. Mine and yours. Not just theirs. Well, God would never turn on me. I'm special. He can see the little flower in this dung heap that you can't see. My sweat doesn't smell. I walked through that one quite niftily too, didn't I? Guilty. All of us. God's mercy is abundantly displayed. He chose out of Ur of the Chaldees a people to keep the light of His grace and love and solution to the problem alive. And He sent His Son to move into a tent of human flesh and be made in the likeness of sinning flesh, but knew no sin. And then to one through eternity had known the light of God's presence and felt the incapacity of God to embrace sin, had to cry out when God laid on Him the sins of us all, "Father, why hast Thou forsaken me?" God hates sin. Every little bit of it. He loves the sinner, the being who sins. He hates sin and the condition it produces. All revealed in the gospel, God's slow buildup of wrath against all ignoring of Him. All non-God awareness, all failure to perceive He is, all failure to recognize His creative hand, all failure to recognize His person, His being, and His power, and all resistance to His ways. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to our own way. And the Lord laid on Him, that's the mercy side, the iniquity of us all. Having said, the gospel is God's ultimate rescue effort. The gospel is the good news. You need to trace, as I have, I'm time today, I could trace the word God itself to good. The good side of God. Maintaining His integrity in His own righteousness. Once, like that parent. Let me go back to that analogy. You sit there and you come to the conclusion your son's guilty. And you have the capacity, if he will trust you, to give him something that will so change his nature that he will become a new creature in Christ Jesus. And the analogy breaks down because I'm leaving out the element of the price that is paid for this that the parent can give. And the evil son refuses that deliverance. Now you not only accept the fact he's what he is, and I hate what he is, he's worse. He has sneered at and spit on the possibility of change. That's the context. These passages come after announcing the good news. The good news is that the people from 118 to 132 and on into 320 have a way out. God's been boiling. He's pushed them to their own handiwork. He knows better than anybody the state of them. He laid all of their sins on His own blessed Son, past, present, and future. And He offers sinning, evil humanity a way out if they'll trust Him. Acknowledge Him. I could go ahead to a passage. Acknowledge His existence. Worship Him for what He is. And be grateful. Be thankful for what God has provided and trust Him. Instead, our sinful condition compounds. It was compounding because God pushed us before the gospel became reality. That was 2,000 years ago. It's compounding today as anyone sits under the blessed message of redemption. And what God says in these next two verses is, I got to read, hard as it is for me, what God says in these next two verses, which you have in front of you, because that which may be known, gnosis is the word, gnoston from experience, about the God, Tutheu, is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them. What can be known about God, if I read it in the Internet New Revised Standard, what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, His eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things He's made. Now, I started out trying to get us into God's perspective. Looking as God looks. God doesn't have any, let's assume for a moment, you dialectical reasoning geniuses. For purposes of argument, let's assume for a moment that God really exists. He is all powerful. He spoke and nothing became everything. He created the worlds and all that's in it. We're still discovering galaxies and galaxies, billions of light years away. The light is reaching us now. The set off billions of years ago on His journey. And you don't have to have a little temporary problem to know what wonderful creative instruments these eyes are. And I've studied vertigo a little bit that can come from eyes and infection and a variety of things and the wondrous elements in here that operate to keep a simple thing we take for granted like balance. I mean, there's a flat in the Olympics right now. The Russian gymnast that was projected to win took a bad fall because the committee responsible for these things had the vault, I think it was the vault, 2 inches lower than normal. And that 2 inches half or two-thirds of the way through the program, one of the other competitors, who was used to seeing how high it should be in relation to her own body, demanded a measurement, and they discovered it was 2 inches off. And that bad fall made this Russian gymnast lose her confidence, and she fell on another event. Well, when they discovered, they gave those who had gone before the discovery a chance to try again. She wouldn't even try because she had already lost any possibility of a gold because her confidence shattered. She had fallen on the next event. I look at those vaulters. Man, on a parachute, I couldn't find the top of it. I can't believe some of the things I'm seeing. This intricate thing we call our body and mind. Now, be God. He hurled all this into space with a spoken word. And out of all the universe, as far as we know, life would be miserable anywhere else. Even science fiction produces the aliens that look like freaks. Would you want to marry one of them? And puts man in this, oh, you know, the glass always half empty, it's not half full. He could have landed you on Mars, wearing space suits. And said, now pose for Playboy. I'm being ludicrous. This is a pretty good place to live. At its worst. Oh, you know, here comes the moronic dialogue. Well, not so good when you're in the middle of an earthquake. Training ground, short time or long, miserable time or sweet, is still opportunity for joys eternal. And a window into the family of God to rule and reign over a new heaven and new earth. That's God's view. He already had one rebellion in heaven. He doesn't want another one. And he has decided that he would fill that vacuum with someone who would trust him. And he tried with Adam and Eve, and they believed the devil and doubted him. He's been looking for trusters ever since. And whether your time is short or late, whether your time here is a miserable time or a good time, it's an opportunity to prove trusting capacity. And what are the sufferings of this time compared to the joys eternal? I'm trying to talk from God's perspective. You got a kid, you take a candy bar from him, and he thinks it's the end of the world. He doesn't know anything about utilities, taxes, or hard work. He's got a little training to do to improve his lot in life here. Now expand that to the moment of time here. And God's looking on and has given us this best in the universe playground. And we want to get off earth because we skin our shins in the playground. I was around a person once, worked for me, was a woman. She was always, I wish I could die. Until one night she thought she was. I'm going to commit suicide. Well, here's the gun. From God's view, he set up a place pretty good. And we go about ignoring him. saying he doesn't exist. Paul's making a declaration. He's saying from God's view, there are enough footprints in the creative universe, there are enough fingerprints for anyone except a perverse person who doesn't want to believe in God. There's enough evidence of a supreme being. That's all he's saying at this point. He's not talking about a savior. He's not talking about a way of salvation. He's not talking about revelation. He's saying if you are in the boondocks of nowhere and have never heard a Bible or seen one, don't know Abraham from a jackrabbit, or Jesus Christ from a billy goat, except someone perversely wanting otherwise from God's view. You see, he don't have to be fair. Well, now, I don't like where you're going with this argument because God's got some proving to do to me. And God's saying, up yours. I am that I am. And I left enough wigglies and footprints that those that have it can recognize and see there is someone, a supreme. God to be God, God to be supreme. Being, personal. Well, evolution can talk all at once. It just can't make that gap from a mechanistic world to personal beings. This universe has a person behind it with the capacity to have purpose and plan, and the power to make it go his way. And God is saying, I've left enough evidence for any hominoid to see it. Whoa, 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 wait a minute, God. No, I've waited all the frickin' I want to. I'm tired of waiting. There's enough evidence. Let's read in the King James. It's the closest one here. The print's a little bigger. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it to them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. What's understood? Eternal power and Godhead. The words, dunamis power and divinity, theotis, divinity. That there is a supreme being. I told you last Sunday. There are people who will tell you man crawled out of some previous state and started worshiping animism, then polytheism, and eventually graduated to monotheism. No, there are multiple studies that have blown that one out the window. The oldest religious urges documented in archaeology, philology, and any other source, original man, earliest religious concepts, monotheism, one God. The rest was added. Thus, God is saying, argue with him all you want. I said, assume with me quite a few minutes ago, that he exists. Now, he's going to provide a way out of our condition and take those that trust him to be his family throughout eternity, even ignoring for the moment the evidence in his revelation
that he made choices before the world were formed. In his omniscient ability to know what the woof and warp of our various being would be, he knows. And no man cometh to the Father save the Spirit growing. And when that Spirit is not drawing you, you can't initiate the move. So you're one of the luckiest people on earth that you have this capacity to recognize, I can't put arms and legs and fibers and detail, but there's someone supreme that started all this, brought it into being, and is controlling it. That's all Paul's saying at this point. And that's all God is saying. He's saying that everybody, this message hardly fits you and me because you have the revelation in front of you. But the whole world, don't ask about, what about the heathen that never heard of Jesus Christ, or as I said earlier, don't know the difference between him and the billy goats. There's enough footprints of God in the creation to make all but a pervert with a perversion away from God, a perverse non-God awareness, a perverse my way at all cost. Only perversity like that prevents recognition. Though I may give him different shape and name and form, there is a supreme being. He's going to go on to say, furthermore, God hath put it in the heart of man. That's why shrines are built by the most ancient of mankind in archaeological finds. You don't find shrines in elephant graveyards. Mankind is basically worshipful. Thus, God declares at the end of this 20th verse, they're without. Because the footprints and the fingerprints are there to be seen. Not everybody's going to see it. Carl Sagan, one of the greatest astronomers, scientists in the world, he openly declares, he doesn't see God in the universe. And as I said last Sunday, the Soviet cosmonaut, when he returned from one trip, said, I didn't see God. Okay. God's looking on. He's an Asabian. He's an Nicaean. The issue, if you stayed in my frame of reference, is if there is a God, he's making the decisions here. He's the boss. And at one point, you know, you let your kids when they're growing up think that you have to be fair. This modern idea. You got to explain everything to them. You got to be fair. And they got to come to their own decision that what you tell them to do is right. In their view, you're going to produce a host of criminals. I've told you. You need to put a rug right in the middle of your one room in your house. And tell your kids, don't you ever get on that rug. Ever. Why? Because I said so. If you got a wife that says, don't be that unfair with our kids, divorce her. And you may end up like me, getting better. If the child learns that from the father, it'll be easier for God to teach him later. Oh, everything's got to be explained. And we got a generation, they say, well, God owes me an explanation. He doesn't owe you a damn thing. You're one of the luckiest people in the world. You wouldn't be here. I mean, I remember that kid in testimony service in my dad's church. He's about 9 years old. One, thank the Lord, saved me and filled me the Holy Ghost. One, thank the Lord, my mom and dad, because if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here. You got that, didn't you? Well, sometimes I wish God unleashed his wrath sooner, because if he had, I wouldn't be here. But now that I'm here, I'm glad I'm here. You understand what I'm saying? God doesn't owe us anything if he is God. He's been PO'd for a long time. It's been building up. He just can't stand the sight of it. Well, I'm not sure God is here, you know. I mean, I go through my day and I don't see God. And then all of a sudden I have an emergency. In case you're there, help me. No God awareness. God says, because my tracks are there to see, they're without excuse. Look at that word. Without excuse. Ana apologetus. Is that what you have? Ana apologetus. You know, ana means up. And apo means out from. And in the heart of this word is that word log, from which we get logos and we get leg. Leg and log. Remember those two words that talk to you? It's to choose out, to separate, to enumerate, to count, to select via words. And the ultimate selector, the ultimate word of God, the ultimate sayer, the last word, who when he says it, that's it, was eternal, facing God, turned from God, John says, struck a tent of human flesh and brought the word to us. I've told you from Ephesians, God's name is blessed God, eulogia, from which we get eulogy that we preach at funerals, say good things about them when they're dead. God decrees that to the saints, to us, blessings from him will come by a logos, word. And he is saying to us, up, up, and away with all of your words. Let your mouth finally be silenced. I've had enough. I got a slow boil. I pushed you into your ways. I want it understood. Wherever you are, whatever the level of your understanding, whatever your prideful expectancy, that God owes you an explanation, you are out of words. You are without excuse. There is nothing that you can say in your defense for ignoring the way out I've offered you. Tolerance that produced a continued slow buildup of my wrath. Frustration with your condition that would cause me to push you down the track of what you want to do. Turning you over. I will not add to that, letting you bore my ears with your mouth. You know in your heart of hearts, you're without excuse. The God that gives you life, an opportunity for eternity. And you keep arguing when you're without excuse. Let me read to you from James Montgomery Boyce, the Presbyterian preacher. No human being is infinite, Infinitude belongs exclusively to God. Yet, in spite of our finite nature, human beings do seem to have an almost infinite capacity for some things. One of them is for making excuses. Accuse a person of something, and regardless of how obvious the fault may be, and I know I'm godlike because this really angers me as I confront it all the time. Accuse a person of something, regardless of how obvious the fault may be, and don't any of you, including me, even try to sit there and tell God up and away, I'm not guilty of what he's saying right now. Yeah, well, you're guilty of it, and you're lying when you say you're not. Listen to this. Accuse a person of something, and regardless of how obvious the fault may be, the individual immediately begins to make self-serving declarations. It wasn't my fault. Nobody told me. My intentions were good. You shouldn't be so critical. Some people try to brazen things out by denying the need to make excuses. Walt Whitman once wrote, I do not trouble my spirit to vindicate itself or be understood. Well, that's God's right, not his. And the French have a saying that has a similar intent. Qui s'excuse, s'accuse. And as my French professor would say, no. Qui excuse, s'accuse. He who excuses himself, accuses himself. That is an excuse itself, since it means that the person involved too great to need to make apologies. I'll read you something else. Dale Carnegie, now here's a guy who knew how to work the center. Dale Carnegie, in his perennial bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People, bases his approach to people management. Now, I've read this book. I could do this if I weren't a little convicted at encouraging your fast descent into God's wrath. He bases his approach to people management on the premise that others rarely admit to having done anything wrong, and it's therefore pointless to criticize them. Let me read that again. You're going to enroll in this course, I'm sure. Dale Carnegie, in his perennial bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People, bases his approach to people management on the premise that others rarely admit to having done anything wrong, and that it is therefore pointless to criticize them. My favorite example from the book is a saying of Al Capone, the Chicago gangland leader who for years was the Federal Bureau of Investigation's public enemy number one. Capone was as sinister as they come, a hardened killer, but he said of himself, quote, I have spent the best years of my life giving people the lighter pleasures, helping them to have a good time, and all I get is abuse, the existence of a hunted man. I'm here, guilty. Come on. God says he's tired of it. Up and away with your words. You're without excuse. And without excuse, you don't want to get up in the morning and worship God for the breath that you wake up with. You don't want to go to work, however unpleasant or pleasant, thanking him for the life you have. You don't want to live a life of thanksgiving. You want to live a life of gripe. You want God on trial, which is why he abandoned the Israelites. God's an expert at excuses. And he gave his son, and the urgency to get the gospel out, which is why we take it to the world, is that God's wrath is reaching a breaking point and it's already leaking out. He doesn't like our condition, and he doesn't want friends bad enough to accommodate himself to it. He takes you, covers you with the garments of Christ, puts his life in you and me, and takes us to eternity as his family when we trust him. And if your perverse brain wants to camp in that realm that a British writer now turned American calls the two minds, in which he puts doubt, unlike the Greek, as a midpoint. That doubt is between unbelief and faith. But it can never stay static. It will either turn to faith or more rapidly turn to disbelief. And he has seven houses of doubt in the book he wrote that produce unbelief. And the first one he starts with is where we will be in our next verses as I move on in Romans, ingratitude. That's why the Bible is so full of admonition of praise, and that's why as you watch the man after God's own heart through the book of Psalms pour out his heart in praise, you cannot get up every day like I bought my watch once to remind me of God's presence if the resurrection is true and had alarm go off. You can't get up and make yourself think from morning to night. Bear a list in your mind. What can I be thanking God for now? There's a lot I've been griping about, but what can I give thanks for? You can't do that and continue to be un-God aware. And the gratitude and the thanksgiving and the talking to God about it with praise keeps an atmosphere of God awareness. And when you look back on what God has seen you through and begin to thank Him for, I can think of some that I know in this audience that thought that something was going to kill them. I remember one that thought he was in a Kafka movie. And my guess is that a host of you throughout this congregation have been delivered even in this past year of something marvelous by God. And you stop thanking Him because you're in a state of non-God awareness and still in your rebellious mindset that God owes you something more than the gift of His Son and the open door where He takes your feeble trust like a baby child and makes you His own and puts His life in you and leads you through ever-increasing faith. My God, have I got a lot to thank God for when I consider the women I've had that God got rid of and the wonderful gift I now have. There are things to thank God for, is what I'm saying. I don't want to turn into channel 406. But you know, is there something you can thank God for?
Yes,
have you been practicing thankfulness? See, I'm on next Sunday's message and I'm not there yet. Because what God's wrath is not only against the ignoramuses that ignore Him and go their own way, trying to argue, well, I still got some questions. No, argument's over. I sent my son. You may not know about that, but when the gospel comes, you better grab it, because all of you are without excuse. I left footprints of my supreme being. And furthermore, you've got some warp in your being, as next Sunday's message will say, that makes you perversely turn against this knowledge, the end result of which you quit being thankful to God for the reality and the patience. Well, he ain't been too nice to me. Well, it's Eugene Scott knows, I deserve hell eternal. That's the state he found me in. That's what Ephesians says. That's why the gospel is not to be preached, because it'll make you rich or this or that. We were dead in trespasses and sin. Guilty. Guilty of ungodliness, non-God awareness, self-awareness, ruling supreme. Guilty of going our way, not His way. Thus deserving eternal damnation and separation from the source of all light. And He reached to us and provided an open door so simple that as you are, I'll cleanse you, renew you, enliven you, recreate you, and take you as my son anew if you'll trust me and shut up your carping, doubting mouth. That's my message.